This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian. The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark.
Every day, in every way, Great Britain lives up to its name. And I know this, we can make it greater still.
David Cameron declares an all-out assault on poverty, but will his fine words be backed with action? Also this week, George the Builder.
Some people stand on the sidelines, some want to knock things down. We are the builders.
And he was called the best Labour leader we never had. We look back on the political life of Dennis Healey, who died this week at 98. Joining me for all of this, we have the Guardian social affairs editor, Randeep Ramesh, commentator Anne Perkins, and the Observer's political editor, Toby Helm. A warm welcome to you all on our return from Manchester. So, David Cameron used his first conference speech as Prime Minister of a majority government by challenging his party to deliver a greater Britain, to banish poverty and to eliminate what he calls the passive tolerance of segregation. Toby, we often have a bit of politicians challenging their own party. Tony Blair used to do it a lot. Did this one jump out as more than the ordinary in that regard?
Yes, I think it did. I think it went further than people were expecting. And yeah, just in the same way that Tony Blair used always to say the unthinkable to his own party in order to stop any sense of complacency, Cameron did precisely that to the Tory party yesterday. And I think that this was the speech that David Cameron had wanted to give for a long time. But throughout the last 5 years, he felt increasingly under pressure from UKIP on the right and the right in his own party. And this was the speech, I think, that emotionally Cameron wanted to give, but also tactically he felt the need to give, planting the Tories on the centre ground, saying things to his own party that they didn't expect to hear, but that they couldn't really argue with. I thought it was a major strategic move by Cameron, and I thought he pulled it off basically extremely effectively.
And do you think that people are listening at this stage of the game? Obviously not many people are tuning in to watch the whole speech, but just the clips on the news and so on. I mean, do you think he's still at a point where people are listening enough so he can paint a different picture of himself?
I don't know. It's always hard to judge, isn't it, how far conference speeches reach out beyond the conference hall. But what he has done is set a benchmark, rather in the same way that the early speeches he made after he became leader, when admittedly the slate was much blanker, have been a point at which we have repeatedly returned to hold him to account. I mean, the hoodie-hugging, husky, cozying up to Tory party leader, you know, we haven't seen for the last 5 years. So I think he's at least set a framework and established a direction of travel. I think it's very important. I mean, we talk about him challenging his party. I think we need to catch up with where the Tories are. Mm. I think the Tories are already a very different party from the party of our imagination. I think they I think certainly any Tory under about 50 is much more socially liberal than their parents. I think they have a much more nuanced idea of how you can use the state. I think they are much more both individualistic but also communitarian than we give them credit for. And I think we really, really need to get our brains around the way that they have grasped what I think is a very important social and political development. And I don't think that, you know, progressives have really properly understood that.
I mean, he obviously talked about being in a hurry. He talked about how, you know, he'd more or less fixed the economy as he sees it, now it was time to fix society, something he talked about years and years ago. And yet, Randy, with your eye on all the social policy stuff, the job of doing all the cutting that he wants to do isn't finished. Can he square this new compassionate conservatism with what's going to be announced by his Chancellor next month in the spending review?
I think he can square it as long as he demolishes countervailing power bases, as long as people don't act upon the very threadbare evidence that we're left with after the Conservative government has removed the right to report poverty, for example. There's tax credits changes that will change the definition of poverty, so we'll no longer see that. After it forces people to pay very high tribunal charges, meaning that there's a drop-off, dramatic drop-off in discrimination cases. It's done through smoke and mirrors. Once you control the facts, as it were, you control the argument. And that's what he's doing. Demolish the trade unions, neuter charities. Where will opposition come from? Will it come from the Parliamentary Labour Party? Well, they look confused to me. So really, he seeks to move. I always thought that he'd move to the right and take the 4 million voters from UKIP that he'd lost. But perhaps not. Perhaps he thinks they're too stubborn and resistant. And maybe he's going to be too pro-EU for them anyway. And that's what he ends up with, looking to occupy this underground. And how can he do it? Because his political project is not to win over the poor and disenfranchised. It's basically to chop off the creamy top layer of the middle class, which was traditionally Labour, progressive, and win them back into the Tory fold.
Do you think, though, that sometimes the words might matter? You gave quite a dark analysis there of the prospects for, you know, social mobility, equality or whatever, if it's becoming impossible to take an employment tribunal, what you're going to do about discrimination, etc. And we could do the same thing on housing and in other areas. But there are fields of social policy, you think of sentencing, for example, a Liberal speech from Michael Gove this week, where historically, the simple words that politicians use do sometimes matter because of reframing the argument.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Michael Gove, before he approached education, produced the same outreach policy, which was to reach out and tell teachers they were brilliant. And actually, when policy arrived, it was underlaid with a very strong sense of social conservatism, which really was rooted in behavioural side of education. And the same thing will apply to probation services. You will be helped and hassled your way out of prison, but you'll be overseen for the rest of your life, I suspect, by a private company paid for by the state to make sure that you don't do anything wrong. Now, that may be a great thing, but it's not a progressive thing. We don't, you know, that is not the individual being allowed to sort of reconfigure themselves and live a full life afterwards. That's about the state overseeing them for the rest of their life in a cheaper format than being put in prison.
So, Toby, it sounds like Randeep still needs a lot of convincing that there's any genuine change here. It's still the same programme described in a very different way.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, if you look at Cameron in the last 5 years, I mean, Cameron came to be Tory leader in 2005, making himself, you know, on a platform of modernisation and liberalism and pro-green and soft, cuddly Toryism. Mm. His first term was saw that just gradually being eroded. So we're right to be deeply cynical and suspicious of another change back to the old soft Cameronism. However, what I would say is I think that Cameron, when you talk to him, when you see him, when you talk to people around him, he doesn't want to be remembered as a hard-edged right-wing Tory leader who drove through austerity in order to put the economy right. He does genuinely, I think, want to be remembered as somebody who did address the social problems of this country. And I think that's the legacy he has in mind. He does not want to be seen as another Thatcher. He wants to be seen as a social healer, if he can. And I think, you know, time will tell. But I think his instinct and his desire for a legacy is on that side of the argument.
And the fixation with the legacy, of course, is because the clock is now ticking. He said he's only going to do two terms, and he has already had one of them. And so this week inevitably had feel of a bit of a beauty parade amongst the various people who might take over from him. Foremost amongst them, his friend and neighbour, George Osborne, who made his only appearance on the Tory fringe at a Guardian event with our editor-in-chief, Kath Viner. I asked her what she made of him.
The most interesting parts for me was the way he's absolutely fixed on tax credits, on cutting them. There's no going back. He said he absolutely has no plan B for the families who will lose out. He's completely committed to them, which was startling. I also asked him more lightheartedly about his physical transformation and the transformation in his popularity. I've lived abroad recently for a few years, and when I left at the end of 2012, he was deeply unpopular, had been booed at the Paralympics, had had the Omni Shambles budget and the pasty tax and all sorts of things. And I come back and he's much slimmer, much better dressed, although quite often wearing a high-vis jacket than a hard hat, but I think that's part of the story, and suddenly seems to be trying to be friendly, trying to get to the centre ground, although I think that's tough for them, and he's trying to be sort of consensual and open. So I was asking him what's changed, and he answered that very interestingly. He said that he felt like at the end of 2012 he'd got himself into a hole. That was the quote, and he said he retreated into the Treasury because he felt kind of so bewildered, I think, by what had happened. So that was quite a personal insight into Osborne.
And the other personal thing you pushed him on was his prime ministerial ambition, which you nudged him on in a number of ways. Did he look like a man who's obsessed with getting to the top?
I think he probably is obsessed with getting to the top, but realises that showing that you are would be the very worst thing you could do at the moment, since the next election's not for 5 years, or general election anyway. I think although he said he thought David Cameron would stay until 2020, nobody believes that.
And George Osborne, the builder, if we had Dave the healer, Toby was talking about before, but George the builder, it was, in more than one sense, a more concrete speech, I thought, than Cameron's, wasn't it, about what he was actually going to do rather than the values that he admired.
There was an awful lot about what he was going to do and really not very much about the constraints within which he was going to be working. I think it's important to remember that I think it's in the beauty contest terms, I think it's significant that it wasn't a very good speech. He doesn't have a very impressive platform presence. And that's one of those kind of small things that matters. So however relaxed and engaging, and I was at that fringe, and he did give a very good account of himself. And you could see that he's, you know, he's not your conventional Tory. He's got a very wide range of and very genuine range, for example, of cultural interests and cultural references. But he's also economically extremely dry. And, you know, he came up with this really bold plan, or rather developed further his very bold ideas about devolution.
Mm.
And he said, most unusually, he said, I'm not sure if this is going to work.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an astonishing thing to hear a politician make. But it's also a very engaging thing. He's challenging people out there in local and city government to help him make it work. And it suggests an openness of attitude, which I think is quite a constructive way to go. Of course, the great fear is that he ends up simply devolving cuts. And I think there's a real anxiety about quite how he thinks this kind of nightmarishly complex business of local government finance can be simply cut loose from Whitehall in a way that doesn't reflect the needs of some of the areas of Britain which have never really recovered from the end of heavy industry.
There was some very good detail for nitpickers in the George Osborne Northern Powerhouse stuff, wasn't there, Randy? Because business rates are going to be handed over to town halls for the first time in a generation, except if they want to increase it, they've got to win a vote, not just of people, but of businesses. So yeah. Votes for businesses smuggled
well,
into that.
That was clever. I think that really what you're looking at is a sort of Crossrail model. That's what the Boris Johnson joke was about, theft of City Hall policies. So Crossrail is paid through a sort of levy on business rates. And that's what George has taken and applied to the rest of the Northern Powerhouse region. And the reason that I think he needs businesses to come along at is historically Britain has a very high rate of business taxation. So business rate taxation is very high in this country. So that you need to win businesses, over in order to levy more tax on them. It won't be easy. And unfortunately, some of the analysis that I've seen coming out of Manchester is that Tory Trafford and Lib Dem stroke Tory controlled Stockport do very well at this deal, and everyone else does pretty badly. So politics hasn't gone away. Politics as usual, I'm afraid. I kind of think George Osborne is a much more appealing character in lots of ways than David Cameron, not least because I think his rhetoric has been largely what he does, what he says. You know, I mean, he's much more on the right, and he is a genuine socially liberal chap. But that's my sort of reading of him. I think he's much more comfortable with metropolitan, cosmopolitan ideals that, you know, I probably, you know, sit easier in my sort of mind as well. So lots of reasons why I think he's an appealing character. I just don't think he comes over to me as very wooden on television.
It's impossible, isn't it, Toby, to imagine George Osborne being taken seriously if he was talking about equality and the children pushing their noses up against the window and so on that Cameron did. There's a slight kind of life as a game air about him, isn't there? That's a problem for him compared to Cameron.
Yeah, I think he hasn't prepared the ground as well as Cameron has in that. But I mean, there were good sections of his speech in which he made those arguments. But I think Osborne does come across to people for what he is, which is ultimately a tactician. And the whole Northern powerhouse thing is the most fantastic, on so many levels, piece of political tactics. If you look, you know, Manchester City with 96 councillors, 96 are Labour. So what is the message that Osborne takes to Manchester? It's about the Northern powerhouse. And what is all that about? It's obviously about trying to say the Tories care about the North. But politically, what it's also doing is it's splitting Labour. And all those Labour councillors in Newcastle, Leeds, Sheffield, Manchester, heads of those councils, are now more willing to talk to the Tories than they are to talk to Corbyn's Labour Party. So he's driving a wedge between the Labour Party.
They can see Labour's not in for a while, so
but they're genuinely enthusiastic about the ideas that Osborne is promoting. And even more extraordinarily, tactically, these are ideas that were actually developed by Labour. So he's just stolen them off their plate and gobbled them up
they're
themselves.
But they're ideas. I think this kind of fits with what I was trying to say
ideas.
Earlier about the...
They're genuinely
about,
good
about,
ideas.
About how the Tory party's changed.
I agree
changed.
With you absolutely about the, how the Tory party's changed.
But, you know, the thinkers in both parties can see that Whitehall no longer conveys trust and competence to anyone. And therefore you've got to either devolve responsibility, the Tories will put it to individuals for their own individual circumstances, or to cities and regions for their well-being. I mean, it's interesting they've had that the capacity to vary business rate has been available for several years, and curiously nobody's actually done it, rather as the SNP has never raised taxes, income tax in Scotland. Obviously, elected politicians don't like raising taxes. But I think this is all part... I think one of the remarkable things about this week was that, with the really notable exception of Theresa May, most of the main platform speeches all fitted into the same project that David Cameron spelt out very effectively from the platform, which is about redefining the state and reimagining the politics of the
does
right
he have
like.
That control, Anne? I mean, Cameron, you say we're talking about Gove, Osborne, Cameron, you know, the three big names who were behind Cameron at the beginning. And then Theresa May, you mentioned as an exception, extremely anti-immigration speech. People are also reading some very anti-European things into what Boris Johnson said, demanding the unrealisable.
Could say that's anti-European, but also you can't talk to people's fears about immigration without addressing the Europe question, and that's the great problem for the Tories, and that's Cameron's particular huge problem with the way the EU referendum's coming down the track, and migration remains one of the biggest, if not the biggest, concern in every single opinion poll.
The new tone, I think, was partly designed in a wider sense to soften people up for the gradual turning of the ship towards a more pro-European, a bigger acceptance of the European Union and its benefits. I mean, Cameron a year ago was talking negatively about the European Union at every turn. The language from him, at least, and several other cabinet ministers now, is the benefits are unquestionable. And you wouldn't have heard that a year ago. So the wider softening of the message is part of
it
that.
I think it is really about jockeying for position. I think that all players have done pretty well this week, in the sense that May and Boris have obviously said, who is the person leading the negotiations in the EU? It's George Osborne.
Mm.
So he will have to come back with a pro-European deal. In the referendum, as it approaches, they will have to decide whether they're going to be in or outers. And whether they're
allowed. They being the individual ministers.
They will have to be, and at that point, you know, we're probably, you know, the government behind you and the Labour Party behind you, you're probably looking at a victory to stay in which case the outers have to make a judgment over whether that will play well internally in the party, whether that will see them through to take power on the back of that. Are they insurgents, like Ian Duncan Smith, or are they part of the winning side?
It strikes me that David Cameron's leaving it very late to make his position clear on whether the whole cabinet is going to have to vote for his renegotiation. Where do you think Theresa, for example, is going, Toby?
I think it's a very good question. I don't know. I thought it was completely extraordinary that she should make a strident anti-immigration speech, not acknowledging any of the benefits of immigration, really, the day before David Cameron makes one rowing in the other direction. It almost looked to me like Cameron must have seen that speech too, that Cameron wanted to kind of isolate her. So I think she may simply have misread the situation and struck out on her own, thinking that is a good piece of territory for her to be on. But while the rest of the party is rowing in the other direction.
There is also the 4 million votes, which I disagree, they're not all Tory voters. You know, there was a significant number of Labour voters in there. There was quite a few
Second
people
that
Ed Balls know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think politicians are really, of all parties, are trying to work out how you kind of say, I feel your pain. And the generous interpretation of what May was up to was trying to kind of re-engage with them. If you think back to the 60s and 70s, in fact, what prevented racial tension getting out of hand generally was an immensely strong lead from the centre. Arguably, that's where the politicians should be now. But we're not there. We're not in the 70s.
It's interesting that you would have, in normal times, you might have seen that Theresa May Cameron disparity on immigration as a sort of good deliberate. Good cop, bad cop.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel like that at all. It actually felt like leadership jostling. Cameron actually trying to squash.
There is a row, though, about who has control over immigration policy, about the students, numbers being transferred to business. Yeah. With the loss of that, she can't really do anything.
I also think, just very finally on this, that it's very interesting, the game Nicky Morgan was playing at the conference.
Well, for anyone who's not conferenced out, there's lots more still on our website, theguardian.com/politics.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Now he's being called the best Prime Minister we never had. Dennis Healey, one of the biggest beasts in the post-war Labour Party, died at the age of 98 this week. This was a man who stood and battled the hard left in the form of Tony Benn in the early 1980s. And perhaps because of that, there seemed to be a bit of an edge to many of the tributes to him this week.
From the left, you mean?
Well, from both sides. I mean, people were trying to work in messages along with that. He was a great man who did, John McDonnell was saying, he stuck with Labour. He could have joined the SDP. And other people were saying, Tony Blair, for example, said he saved Labour as an instrument of government, I think.
Which I think is probably, remembering back to those very difficult years for Labour is probably not a bad assessment, because he did carry, for all that Andrew Roberts, the historian, rather unfairly called him the worst Chancellor that Britain had ever had, people trusted him. People from across the political spectrum trusted him. He did carry great authority. He was a very clever man. He was a very clearly unquestionably courageous man. Even when he was wrong, he never shirked a fight. And I can see, while he was in the Labour Party, Labour still looked like a serious party. I think if he had left, I really do. I mean, I really think that would have been catastrophic. But I was very amused watching Michael Cockerell's film about Dennis Healey on television last night, and watching Shirley Williams' very careful, barbed remarks about how deeply unpleasant it was to work with him. He was a very arrogant and difficult and and conceited individual.
There's a great little bit of post the national treasure status he's acquired from Peter Wilby in this week's New Statesman, where it talks about him once almost breaking Roy Hattersley's jaw, and Roy Hattersley would have been on the same side of most of the arguments for him. And then years later, as a supposedly mellow old man trying to get his photos he was very proud of in The Independent on Sunday, and when the editor rung up and apologised and said, "Well, what do you want me to do about this?" He said, "I want to make you eat shit." So he's not a unifying figure, is he, Randy?
No, no. But I quite like the Fraser Nelson, when he died, tweeted he was the first monetarist, because he squeezed the British economy.
He certainly was.
Yeah, in a way that no one else could.
He cut more out of the British economy
than Osborne,
anyone has.
That was the point. And Thatcher in a book sort of remarks upon, "Oh, look, it works. Stuff, we can do this," which I thought we had much to blame for. But I thought that in sort of political terms, he was just a man with a life. I mean, unlike so many politicians that we have today, he fought in the World War II. He was a man with a life. He played the piano. He made bald jokes. You know, I sort of thought people could learn a lot from having a life.
I don't want to diss that. I'm sorry, Toby. Because of course he did. He was, and he was hugely talented. But I think he really enjoyed. He was a show off, and he loved that aspect of it. He's talking about his sort of physical appetites. He actually socked Adam Bolton in the very early days of Sky too, I remember. So he was.
I thought one of
that was a bit too much life.
One of the telling comments about him came where I read somewhere was from his son, I think. Which just takes you into the sort of family side of him, but it shows you what he was like, where he said that even in a family argument where he's proved demonstrably wrong and everybody can see that he's been proved wrong, he would never, never, never accept that he was wrong.
So yeah,
even in the kind of confines of his own family, he couldn't...
I don't think he could ever have become leader, because I just think he too much enjoyed being brutal. Yeah. I once wrote a counterfactual where I actually created the circumstances in which Shirley Williams was going to be the first leader of the Labour Party, which involved...
First woman leader.
Which involved Healey having cut everybody's budget so fiercely and with such relish that he couldn't garner more than sort of a handful of votes in the party. And I still think that was always going to be his problem.
I also think the fascination with him to an extent was because, I mean, it was very interesting seeing how rich the profiles of him were, the obituaries with him, the discussion about him. And it was almost as if Labour sort of longing to discuss a great figure, and having had a conference where it so spectacularly failed to find a new one.
People talk about him in that leadership election in 1976, where he was there along with Crossland, along with Tony Benn, Michael Foot, Callaghan, who ended up winning, I think maybe Roy Jenkins, I can't remember, but all of these people, of whom this is the last one, I think, you know, really big figures. And you do think, and it's not a party point, on neither side now are there people who are kind of national figures.
No, it's those real Rolls-Royce intellects and fantastically big figures who could, you'd never worry if you were a member of their own party about their performance.
I think we're showing our age. I think we thought they were wonderful because...
No, I remember him being hated, Healey. Incredibly kind of divisive figure and unappealing, actually.
He was still a very
but big.
Kind of big and real figure. Maybe we are all lesser people.
In this summer, where in the Labour tribe, you know, the kind of managerial, technocratic candidates have taken an absolute battering from Jeremy Corbyn, who's at least someone who's put up an argument. And we remember Dennis Healey, as this right-wing chancellor, but, you know, he'd been a young communist. And then when he was involved in fighting Labour, I'm pretty sure it's never quite on the record that Tony Blair voted for Tony Benn as a young mind and as a young man. So it's these big figures came out of big arguments, and maybe, therefore, Randy, we'll get some big figures now. We're having some big arguments again.
I do think you need a bit of that. I mean, as Margaret Thatcher said, the road to Damascus has never been so crowded. I think it's something you need to have a debate about. Unless you have these debates, people won't stand up for what they believe in. They just play the managerial.
I think Tom's absolutely right, actually. It's the need for a really big, proper argument instead of for an endless kind of sort of.
You need to be able to swing your fists.
Yes. Intellectually, we're speaking.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Well, no, maybe literally as well. But on that note, we'll ring the bell and declare the fight over. So my thanks to Toby, to Anne, and to Randeep. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.